intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. A decade ago, in early 2004, one of our listeners from Colorado Springs called into the program. You know, we air on America's most powerful Christian radio station, the 50,000-watt AM 670 KLTT. And so it's neat. We have a lot of listeners in the Springs. And she called to say that the previous evening, watching her local PBS public television station, she saw a documentary called Unlocking the Mystery of Life that suggested that Darwin was wrong and that the evidence showed that life must have been designed. Well, I had a hard time believing that this was possible. I figured she misunderstood the program. How could it be on PBS? It seemed unlikely that such a station would air so much simple common sense. So 10 years later, here at Real Science Radio, that film, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, is one of our best-selling Blu-ray and DVD resources on our online store. Of the scholars and scientists in the film, Paul Nelson has been a major force in the intelligent design movement and also appears in a new film titled Flight, The Genius of Birds. Well, Dr. Nelson is a fellow with the Discovery Institute in Seattle. He's an adjunct professor for the master's program in science and religion at Biola University with a PhD from the University of Chicago in the philosophy of biology and evolutionary theory. It turns out that Paul Nelson was an associate of the famous Philip Johnson of UC Berkeley, who wrote Darwin on Trial. And Paul organized a very significant conference, the MIR conference, like C.S. Lewis's MIR Christianity, the MIR Creation Conference in 1996, where the modern intelligent design research community first formed. So, Dr. Nelson, it's an honor to speak with you here on Real Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, I just watched with my family for the second time two nights ago your latest film, Flight, The Genius of Birds. Thank you for producing this tremendous video, Dr. Nelson.
It was really fun. I've made now four films with Illustra Media. Unlocking was the first one. And this is, Flight is part of an ongoing series called The Design of Life. So there will be more films to come, but I encourage your listeners to check out Flight.
Oh,
it's a wonderful film.
It's just so great. But before we talk about how neat it is, the other films that we carry from you guys are The Privileged Planet, Darwin's Dilemma, and Metamorphosis about monarch butterflies.
Right. And I'm in three of those.
Which three?
They're all Darwin's Dilemma, right, about the Cambrian explosion, the Metamorphosis film about butterflies, and of course, Unlocking, which you mentioned at the beginning.
Yeah, that's right. And now Flight. So the state-of-the-art quality of all these videos, but especially this newest one, Flight, the animation, the graphics, the video. I know I'm jumping ahead, but one of my favorite parts of the video was about hummingbirds. It was stunning to see the animation of the way they drink nectar out of a flower. Who would ever have imagined that such a seemingly simple task, sipping nectar, could reveal such awesomely brilliant engineering?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a fascinating backstory to that. The people at the University of Connecticut who undertook the research began with what you could say is a kind of intelligent design question. They looked at the feeding pattern of hummingbirds and they said there's no way that passive capillary action, such as you might get with putting a straw in water,
yeah,
where the molecular forces pull the fluid up a certain distance, they said that is simply not an adequate mechanism to feed hummingbirds. Hummingbirds have these enormous metabolic demands that they need to eat a lot all the time. So they started with a question saying, these birds are clearly alive, they're clearly eating, but some part of their design has got to be more active in trapping the nectar. So they went in with a kind of engineering question, and they discovered that in fact capillary action is not what's going on. there is an active mechanism where the tongue opens as it enters the fluid and...
Wait, the tongue opens. You're saying the tongue opens. Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Because a hummingbird...
Well, it's a bit hard to say, kind of have to make a visual or a sound picture here.
Yeah,
for
the radio.
Visualize it. But on either side of the tongue, little traps, I guess is the best word to use for them, semicircular traps open and actively trap the nectar and pull it out.
So that when I saw the animation of this, now... You point out in the video the hummingbird has such a high metabolism, it consumes twice its body weight each day. It eats almost constantly throughout the day. That's like an adult human eating 150 pounds of food every 24 hours.
You would park your car in the McDonald's lot and just have them bring you bags all day, basically.
Right. And so when I got to that part of the video and I saw what happens, the tongue is like a tube twice as long as its long beak. And it extends into the nectar, and then it opens up, and there are all these compartments with lids that open up in sequence, and they just absorb the water, the fluid, the nectar, fills them up, and then as it retracts its tongue, they all close, so the nectar doesn't escape, and that's how it drinks. And the brilliance, when my wife Cheryl saw this, Paul, she said, there are so many moving parts, how could it possibly work?
I know. When you think about what's required to get the thing up and running, and you've got to keep the hummingbird going the whole time, the point to stress is that it's an active mechanism. It's not a passive physical mechanism. The tongue is actually grabbing and trapping the nectar.
Let me ask you this about the hummingbirds, the way it feeds.
Yeah.
For one thing, it has to hover almost perfectly still, which no other bird could possibly do.
Right.
And then secondly, the thought of how it could evolve. Because if a hummingbird started out with a simple tongue that just lapped up the fluid and then somehow started down this path, a non-directed path of mutation and natural selection to start creating a compartmentalized tongue with lids that would open and close. I mean, there are so many engineering steps before it could ever become functional.
That's right. And you've touched on a basic principle that we know. We know from our own engineering. If you look, for instance, at the history of human aviation, there was a long period of crashing. People literally paid with their lives to figure out how to have three-axis control, where you can control a heavier-than-air object in three dimensions and move it through space and bring it down safely again. The same principle, but in spades, many, many times over applies to living things. You have to optimize or engineer multiple independent systems that are all interrelated. So there's no point in having this fancy tongue unless, you know, you are able to get at that nectar. But to get at that nectar, you've got to be able to hover. I've watched hummingbirds in Central America moving over the surface of a large flowering plant, and they are really, you know, sort of have an inertial guidance system. They're bopping in and out, in and out, in and out, hitting those flowers, extracting that nectar. As you work your way through the different engineering requirements, the point that you've made comes through clearly. All of these systems need to be sort of co-present to have anything at all.
And when you have that kind of an engineering analysis of what we're looking at in a hummingbird versus the Darwinist story of some creature jumping over fallen logs to catch a flying insect, or creatures jumping up through branches and they start to develop rudimentary flight. It's such a juvenile story compared to the brilliant and difficult engineering challenges of multiple systems simultaneously interfacing.
That's right. And I think an unprejudiced mind presented with the evidence, unless that mind was compelled to offer a certain kind of answer, namely an undirected or naturalistic answer, the rational thing, the sensible thing, the intelligent thing to infer from the evidence is this required engineering. Mm. Certainly we know that when we learn to fly and not kill ourselves crashing into the ground, that it was painstaking. It's remarkable, for instance, if you read the history of the Wright brothers, how they carefully mimicked flying birds in what they were doing and realized if we're going to do this and not kill ourselves, we're going to have to satisfy some basic requirements all at the same time.
Right.
For that, you need a mind and intelligence.
Wow. Another part of the video that each segment could stand alone as a stunning investigation of the natural world. But another part was the video of bird embryos developing.
Oh, yes.
Within the egg. You're also a producer, an associate producer on this film. Any idea where did that video come from? It was just tremendous. It is tremendous.
It was done by Timothy Standish at the Geoscience Research Center in Loma Linda in Southern California. But the start of that is actually an animation, CGI, using really microscopic data because it's too small to see with any kind of
right
any kind of lens that you could put in a film. So using data from micrographs and scanning electron images, the animators recreate the very beginning of the developmental process, and then a little ways into development, they can switch over to what you could see using a microscope. But you can make a hole in the surface of a chicken egg, insert a lens, and film what's going on once the stage of embryo development gets far enough along that you can actually see what's going on. But the very earliest stages, that's animation.
15, 20 years ago on the show, we were attempting to abort living chicken eggs on the air, and liberals were outraged. Pro-choice liberals, unsurprisingly. How about the Arctic terns? They seem like they're relatively small birds.
They're not real big, but boy, are they graceful. I mean, you look at this elegant shape that they have, and they remind me, if any of your listeners have seen photographs of a U-2 spy plane, really long wings for soaring, and little body, but these great big, gorgeous, long tapering wings, a little nice little tail. But boy, do they pile up the frequent flyer miles.
From Greenland to Antarctica, their round trip migration every year, 24,000 miles. And not only Arctic terns, but so many creatures, they have this instinct that I know as a Christian, a creationist, that God gave them this ability. But as a scientist, and you are a philosopher of biology, Dr. Nelson, we like to try to understand, what did God do in the creation? Instinct, is it still a deep mystery for science to understand the instinct that even monarch butterflies and so many creatures have?
Oh, I think it is. And there's an interesting question where that instinct is encoded. Is it in the DNA or is it at a higher level? It's clear that with birds, there is learning involved. So bird watchers will tell you that when you see a bird where it doesn't belong, you know, something shows up and everyone gets excited and runs out with their binoculars or camera to take a look at it, it's often a juvenile that's gone astray. It's lost. And learning, watching an older bird lead you to where you're supposed to go is very important in bird migration. That alone won't work because there has to be an underlying GPS system that will enable you to use that learning. You could sit with a chimp all day and try to teach it English, and you're not going to get very far because the chimp doesn't have the underlying system, whereas a human child picks it up naturally.
Right. The wiring for language is very different from the wiring for animals that bark or chirp and so
on. Exactly.
So some years ago, 20 years ago almost, I was debating on TV for an hour live, Eugenie Scott. You know that name, don't you?
Oh, yes, I do.
Yeah.
She's retired.
Yes, that's right. Physical anthropologist, leading anti-creationist, anti-intelligent design activist. And I asked her for an hour to give me three pieces of evidence that higher biological functions ever evolved. And so finally, she objected to the question, but finally, toward the end of the show, she offered junk DNA. And she said that we know affirmatively that 90% or so of our DNA is junk. And I said, I'm the fundamentalist Christian talk show host. So I said, and we still air these quotes. It's fun, Paul. I said, Eugenie, don't you think we're just at the beginning of our learning curve with genetics, and we will find as we learn more all this function? And she said, no, we know all we need to know that this is all junk. So fast forward to Nature magazine last December. They said so far 90%, we're pretty sure it has function, 90%, and it's moving toward 100%. So if we ever get to 100% of understanding the Arctic Tern's DNA, so we know what all the RNA and the proteins are being coded for, and we say nowhere in that programming code is there anything to do with flying to the Antarctica. You said the information might be at a higher level. Is that maybe like epigenetics or in the cell itself, in the first cell? Because cells carry information.
Cells do carry information. If you think about what happens during reproduction in any sexual species, what's passed on at reproduction is not just naked DNA. You've got, first of all, the egg, which is loaded with information in the membranes and the cytoskeletal structures. One of my colleagues at Discovery Institute, Jonathan Wells, is working on this. There appear to be stores of information in animals in particular, but in other living things as well, that cannot be reduced to DNA. Don't get me wrong, DNA is a wonderful, beautiful molecule, but it doesn't seem to be sufficient to explain what we see.
Right.
And I think intelligent design uniquely, of all the theories out there, illuminates this, because an intelligent designer can begin with a whole system. In fact, that's what we do. We conceive of a function that we want to achieve, and we say, what do I need to bring together, you know, all the bits and pieces? What do I need to assemble to achieve that function?
Mm. Stephen Meyer was on the show a few months ago when his book, Darwin's Doubt, first came out. And I gave him an illustration for epigenetics. He said he might steal it from us, which would be wonderful. And it was that if you vision Manhattan Island as a single cell and it had the ability to duplicate itself, and when it made the second copy, it came replete with tunnels and bridges. And those tunnels and bridges are sort of like the things, the machines in the cell membrane, like the proton pumps and all. And so that stuff is automatically there. The DNA might be in the central library in the center of the cell, but there's all this other stuff that goes along with just cell mitosis, splitting the cell. And so the epigenetics, it could very well be that the information, the instinct for creatures is somehow in that first living cell, even if it's not in the DNA in the nucleus.
I think you've got the right instinct, and I think that makes perfect biological sense. And again, an unprejudiced mind looking at reproduction, looking at what's actually passed from mother and father to offspring, would say, well, it's not just the DNA. You know, if you have isolated DNA, I actually have a little vial here on my desk with my daughter's DNA that she isolated in an AP biology class.
Wow.
It looks like really thick Crisco. But it's no more a living thing than the asphalt on the road outside.
Wow.
It's actually, in certain respects, it's a wonderful store for information, but biologically it's a rather boring molecule. It doesn't do much.
Wow.
In order to get the DNA to unpack or unload the information that it's carrying, you need proteins, you need a cellular context, you need a lot of machinery that is not nucleic acid. Again, this makes sense to me from a design perspective. You have multiple levels co-present to achieve function.
Mm. So when Darwinism became neo-Darwinism with the synthesis of Darwin's ideas with the discovery of genetics, that was the heyday back when Dobzhansky did his Nothing Makes Sense in Biology Except in the Light of Evolution.
Right.
And Paul, you probably know about the Creation Quarterly, the CRSQ.
Yes.
I was honored. They published a paper. I did a 40-year later analysis of Dobzhansky's famous paper. And it's amazing that the predictions he made in that paper, with hindsight, none of them came true. They were all been falsified in stunning ways. And so the evolutionists were like a kid who discovers a hammer and he thinks everything is a nail. So they discovered protein sequencing and they thought that would tell the story. Lo and behold, that undermines the entire story of Darwinism.
You know, what's funny is, or maybe not ha-ha funny, what's odd or sad, is that Darwinian thinking can stand in the way of biological understanding. I think the example you gave a few minutes ago of junk DNA is a perfect illustration of that. Suppose instead you approached the cell and said, there's all this DNA here that appears not to code for protein. How likely is it that it's just junk, or might there be functions there that we need to tease out? Mm. If you had gone that route, instead of saying it's junk, there'd be this huge storehouse of things to learn. So I think a much better heuristic for any biologist when you see something puzzling is not to say, well, gee, I wouldn't have done it that way, or I don't know what it does, ergo it does nothing, but rather to say, it's my job to figure out what's here. If it's here, it may well have a function.
Yeah, why is it there?
Exactly.
And the world lost decades of the opportunity to learn from genetics because we were not looking. That's laid right at the doorstep of Charles Darwin and the neo-Darwinists. It's their fault. They told us, don't look, it's all junk, it's all leftover evolution garbage. Back to the flight, the genius of birds. How about the starlings? Oh, wow, what a beautiful part of the video. Hundreds of thousands of starlings flying as if choreographed in this awesome display of style and beauty. It's like watching music. And Paul, I loved what you said, that our response to this in nature, it transcends words, our response. We respond like we do to great art with our emotions and our soul.
You know, I think we are built as human beings, we are built to detect design, not just at the scientific level, but at these deeper levels that you just mentioned, that we respond to that. And I tell you, you have to step on or crush that natural response that's built into every human being, not to see what's there. You know, when I watch these murmurations, these, you know, 300,000 birds moving as if they're one giant organism through the sky and not crashing into each other.
Right.
What I see is, frankly, in a case like that, our creator's sense of humor saying, you know, they're just dumb birds, but you guys try this. Mm. You know, it's hard enough for you to get six blue angels flying together. Imagine 300,000 of them moving in that pattern.
And, you know, whenever I've read articles about these murmurations, the researchers who are trying to figure it out, and they're very sophisticated in their approaches, but they always say the bird is tracking the bird in front of it and the bird to the right and the left. But they never say, and I always note that, they must also be tracking the bird above it and the bird below it, because
these are
three-dimensional murmurations.
There's a three-dimensional tracking, and it's estimated by a group of Italian researchers that the group that's monitored is the immediate neighborhood of six or seven birds, but in a three-dimensional way. So above, below, right, and left.
Yeah. And in front, and they keep their distance. And whoever decides whether to turn right or left, it's a mystery, but it's just beautiful. A couple other questions about the film, the feather. Oh, you know, we think, you know, the evolutionists say, well, dinosaurs were reptiles. They started growing feathers and, you know, they became birds.
Right.
But when you look, you guys have a feather and then you zoom in and then you transition to animation. And it's so awesome to see the exquisite and intricate design of a feather.
I think that every student should have the opportunity at once in his or her life to look at the structure of a feather through a nice low-powered microscope. You see these little barbules that are hooked onto their nearest neighbor, and the whole thing fits together like a jigsaw puzzle, so that you have a very light but very strong structure which will perform the airfoil function of generating lift. The shaft is hollow. The flight feathers have the right length that they need for this function of lift. But then you go work your way down to, let's say, the legs, and you see the downy feathers.
Oh, and the number
performing insulating function.
And the number of pieces, hundreds of thousands or a million individual parts to a single feather. And we're not talking about molecules. We're talking about parts.
Parts, yes, exactly. I actually have a flight feather from a Canadian goose. I'm looking at it right now. It's right here on the edge of my desk.
Yeah.
And any time I need to be reminded of the reality of design, I just look up and look at this thing and how gorgeous it is.
Oh, and then
beautiful
the video,
and functional.
And then how the video shows three specialized feathers on the Canadian geese wingtip so that when it's landing, it could slow down but avoid stalling.
Yep.
Just anyone who is interested in seeing God's design in nature, I strongly recommend you get this flight, The Genius of Birds, either in Blu-ray or DVD. We carry them both here at Real Science Radio. And by the way, when you purchase it from our store, it helps us stay on the air. We've been doing this since 1991. But Paul, it's titled Volume 1, but as you said, you guys, you had Unlocking and Darwin's Dilemma, Metamorphosis, and then there was The Privileged Planet by Illustra. If this is Volume 1, that means there's another in this new series, is that?
Oh, yes. And the next one that's in production right now is going to be on aquatic life. Whales, dolphins, salmon, jellyfish. We're going to plunge into the ocean and talk about the challenge, for instance, of what would it take to evolve a fully aquatic mammal from a land-dwelling form in the time available.
Yeah.
By Darwinian processes.
You know, because the Darwinists, neo-Darwinists, are going so strong on convergence with, well, for example, the bat, all the genetic coding so the bat can do echolocation, and they find virtually the identical, extensive programming in dolphins.
That's right.
And so, and they say that these two did not have a common ancestor that had echolocation. So you have this astounding, brilliant, sophisticated, and identical programming allegedly developed both in an undirected, coincidental way. That's inane to the greatest extent you could imagine. It's absurd.
It does strain credulity because you're saying an undirected process managed to hit this very, very small target for this specialized system in two unrelated groups. Frankly, I would say, you know what, guys, engineering by a mind is a much better explanation.
Oh, yeah. And if you hired two groups, one from Microsoft, one from Google, of a dozen engineers and said, here, program this, echolocation, and they wrote code, they might end up with 200,000 lines of code. And there's no conceivable way that it's going to look like they're the same program. They'd be so wildly differentiated. And so the fact that they're the same shows us they had the same author.
That's right. And like I said a few minutes ago, the signal is there. The signal is there in nature for any mind that's open to see it.
Mm.
It couldn't be more clear.
Well, this aquatic life, the reason I brought that up, and I know we're about out of time, just one more question after this. But Paul, the aquatic life, we make these predictions on Real Science Radio. We've been doing them for decades. Many of them have come startlingly true, like with the junk DNA and the Hubble deep field image. That was just reinforced with the news story out today. Yet more galaxies that should be young that look like they're old, billions of years old. Anyway, we're considering making a prediction that the Darwinists are going to give up on their claim that marine animals evolved onto land and that some went back into the sea and became whales and all. We think that they might give up on that because of all the evidence against it. And because why not just say it was convergence? If you could get this convergence of bats and whales, why not convergence of mammal features? So we're thinking they might give up on that, even though it's hard to imagine.
Well, you know what? I'll remember that. Let me close with this. Stranger things have happened in evolutionary predictions.
Yes, yes. Now, last thing, Paul, if you have the time.
Sure.
I was in the audience in Pittsburgh this past summer when you spoke to hundreds of authors, scientists, researchers, engineers about intelligent design. And you described a discovery in ants, these little creatures that crawl around on the ground, and what's called orphan genes. As scientists are sequencing their proteins, they're finding what the Darwinists never expected, orphan genes in great number. Could you describe that?
Sure. Here's a good analogy. Imagine that I gave you the task of writing a dictionary of the English language, and I said you got 20 years to do it. Well, initially, you'd find a lot of words, and your sample would grow very rapidly, but eventually it would flatten out. You'd come back to me 15, 18 years later, and you'd say, Paul, the dictionary is complete. We have found pretty much all the English words that there are, and the ones that we find now fall into the ones that we already knew about.
Right.
With genetics, what's happening is quite the reverse. The genetic dictionary of life, the so-called orphan genes, which means a gene that's found in a single species and doesn't have matches genetically anywhere else in the living world, the dictionary of life is vastly greater than anyone realized. So in my talk in Pittsburgh, I spell this out, and I concluded by looking at six ant species that had their complete DNA sequences mapped in 2010-2011. It turns out that about 10% of the genome, the complete DNA of each of those species, was unique to that species.
Whoa.
Well, if you run the numbers, there are 14,000 roughly estimated ant species worldwide. You're talking an enormous number of unique gene sequences that don't have evolutionary precursors. And
oh,
these have to be derived from a common ancestor on the Darwinian picture that had probably about 18,000 genes in its genome. So what's happened, what's been discovered over the last 15 to 20 years using the new technology of DNA sequencing is that the genetic universe on this planet is vastly greater than anyone realized. And my own view as a student of this is these discoveries are going to overturn the picture of the single Darwinian tree because there's going to be too much unique genetic information to be accounted for by a branching tree process.
Wow. So that if Darwinism was true and you had the original mother and father ant and they've all, through common descent, they've all diversified, you would expect that the differences in their genes would be somewhat subtle.
They would be subtle and you could trace them. In other words, just as we have in English, new words that come into the language like rip off, which is a conjunction of the words rip and off, and entered the language in the 60s because hippies needed a word to describe how they felt when someone stole their bag of weed,
yeah,
right?
Right.
But you can trace rip and off back into the language, so the signal of history is still there. The same is the case with genetics. The view was that new proteins and genes came about as copies of old ones. Well, you can trace the history. You should be able to trace the history back to the original set. The problem is with orphans, they don't have any trace of history. They are unique. And their numbers are enormous. 10% of the genome of each ant species, if you run that out to 14,000, you're talking millions and millions and millions of unique genes.
Wow.
So I'd encourage your listeners to pay attention to this because within the next decade, as DNA sequencing becomes more inexpensive and rapid, this signal is going to increase, and I think it's going to create a real crisis for evolutionary theory.
Wow, and as a creationist, my guess, when we meet the creator, and if we ever ask, why are there so many unique genes among all these ant species, that God will say, hey, it was fun. You know, and it showed his brilliance as a creator and an engineer. Hey, thank you, Paul Nelson. What an honor to have you on Real Science Radio.
Oh, it's been a treat. Have me back anytime.
Okay, will do. God bless you.
Take care.
All right, this is Bob Benyart for Real Science Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Our website, realscienceradio.com or rsr.org. That's the shortcut, rsr.org. If you go to our store, Real Science Radio, you can find these great Illustra Media DVDs and our own debates with atheists and evolutionists, so many other materials. I think you'll love it. You'll help us stay on the air. And by the way, a donation wouldn't hurt either. That'd be so wonderful. One time or an ongoing automatic monthly donation on a credit card. That's really the way we stay on the air month to month. So thank you. God bless you for listening. This is Bob Benyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.